These are fun, off-the-cuff discussions on movies and streaming series, both new and old.
Together, we'll attempt to bridge the gap between Hollywood industry insider and the casual viewer.
This is Alec.
And I'm Ben.
And you're listening to the Cinema A to B podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Cinema A to B. Got an interesting film today for us, Alec. This is 1977. The film is titled Sorcerer, directed by the late William Friedkin. I'd had this on a list of stuff to see for a while, and I finally just gave in and bought the Blu-ray and was like, well, let's see what this thing's all about. So I want your initial impressions.
I went in this with no expectations whatsoever. Didn't read up about it before I watched it. Had never seen it before. And I think just like I watched it last week. So sat down, you know, turn everything off, phone down, watch this thing. And he does an interesting thing here. I don't think it works in today's standards or like viewing it from 2024. The lack of dialogue of just letting what's happening on screen. I mean, there obviously is some dialogue, but there's so little of it that it's so much kind of focused on you're just kind of taking in what's happening on screen. And to me, as a 2024 viewer, it didn't really hold up or really didn't work. And afterwards, I went back and like looked at it and saw it like had like a almost an 8.0 rating. It was like 7.7 on IMDb. And I'm just like a little floored because I didn't think it was that good. Like there was good points on it, but there is a lot of things that I had issues with, both from not even just watching it from 2024, but just from a story standpoint, a character building standpoint, like basic movie tenets that just didn't seem to work. That to have this film be so highly regarded, to be so kind of up there, and yet I'd never heard of it. Also, the fact that it says Sorcerer, and I have no idea what that's referencing at all, too, is completely through me. I'm just like, so when's the magic going to happen? When's the Sorcerer going to show up? Like it, Sorcerer, there's actually like hints of like some like magical or like supernatural things that are in the film that never appear. And it's just like, it's just truck drivers. That's really what this movie's about. And I'm like, okay, all right. I have no idea what this is referencing. So, I mean, that could be just me. How about you? Well, like, what am I missing? What, like it, are you feel differently?
I do feel a little bit differently, but I think you have to view this through a lens of 1977. I don't think you can watch a movie like this through a lens of today and fully appreciate what Friedkin's trying to do. But largely you're right. I don't think he really succeeds here with, I think, ultimately what his intent is. Although as far as tension building, this is masterful tension building. And obviously the film, so we're talking about a movie that I feel is relatively obscure here. And so I want to back up for a second. I'm not going to give a full synopsis, but effectively what you're watching is four guys from every corner of the globe, all of them basically on the run, find their way basically in the kind of a nondescript South American country. And they're working for the oil company as basically laborers. And they're selected for a really crazy, dangerous mission to transport nitroglycerin, like 200 some miles to put out this oil well fire. They need to blow the earth around the well to cave it in and quench the fire. There's really no other way to do it. And I believe this is a remake from a 50s movie. I forget the name of it. I believe it was 1954. I'm blanking on the title of the film, but it is effectively a remake. And I believe it's all based on a novel. So the famous scene in the movie is them trying to get these trucks across this crazy rickety
rope bridge, yeah.
Bridge over this river. And that is the penultimate sequence. And that still holds up. In fact, yeah. I was watching that going, how on earth did they do this? And he did it for real. It's all in camera. They really built the bridge. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting story behind that. They were originally supposed to shoot it in one place. There was storms. It didn't work. The water levels dropped too low. They tried to find another location. They ended up building a dam to get the water level back up. And they shoot this thing with real trucks. And the actors are really in the trucks. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you could get away with that now. I, I don't know how safe or not safe this was. The bridge looks rickety. My understanding is it's all reinforced cable that's hidden underneath. Okay. That still holds up. And that scene is like white knuckle. Even from 77, that sequence was just ridiculous. But the thing that confused me was the opening of the film, because you're right, there's no dialogue. And I'm just watching these random vignettes of these guys. The first one's like early on, one of them's in, I believe, like Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And he's basically a terrorist, and him and his boys bomb something. And then most of them get killed, and he runs away. And then you've got another guy in France, in Paris,
who bets on the wrong thing. Yeah.
Yep. And then you have Roy Scheider, who is involved with the mob, and he's the central character. And this is vintage. It's like peak Roy Scheider. This is like one of his last kind of big roles, because this is after Jaws. And then this is his second or third pairing with Friedkin, because French Connection. So I think it's a mixed bag. A
couple things I want to go back to. So obviously I said, like, looking at it from 2024 views, but I will say there are movies like The French Connection, a Friedkin film, still holds up today. I still really enjoy that film. And I didn't watch that until, after you and I had met. So like this wasn't something I grew up watching, in French Connection, but I still think that's a far superior film as opposed to this. And White Knuckle on the bridge, yes, I agree. Like, that was done really well. But I'm going to tell you right now that those four vignettes at the beginning, I feel like you could wipe those out, like not even have them, and you'd still feel the same. Because I'm going to tell you, as someone who gets drawn in by characters, that didn't help me. Like, I didn't really care about most of any of these characters, even Roy's character. Like, and it didn't help that I knew their backstory. Like, it could have literally just plopped me down in South America, and I just meet all four of these guys, and I'd have just as much interest in them than where they come from. The only thing would be the contract killer guy, knowing kind of his background. But I feel that you could have done that in different ways.
Yeah, that it's kind of standard by the book, a vignette here, vignette next. It's probably a little too linear for its own good, but 77, that's
what you do.
The only character that I think that I had a lot of empathy for is Victor, the Frenchman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because his scenario is so much different from the rest of them. Like, I think he committed a crime, kind of, but and that was kind of, frankly, a little too convoluted. Mm-hmm. But he's like the only one that leaves a wife. That's kind of soul crushing. And then his death to me was pretty soul crushing. And I could see it coming. I was just like, oh man. By the way, the guy he's riding with, the terrorist, Kasim, I think.
Yeah.
That actor's Amadou. And I'd seen him in so much stuff. Like, he's the guy in Ronin that they're trying to buy weapons from. And he's like, come in. Yeah. And he's in a bunch of other things.
Well, he's also in Spy Game as the doctor who goes to apply, basically gets blown up trying to kill things.
But yeah, and I thought it was cool to see him as the younger man, just early on in his career. That was really cool. But yeah, I had a harder time emoting with Roy Scheider's character until near the end of the film, when it's just like, this guy's been just stripped of his humanity. And that's what this movie's trying to do, is just it almost serves as a study in human, like, depravity. Mm-hmm. They don't make movies like this anymore. Like, there has to be more going on narratively than this. This is sort of one note that just gets hit again and again and again of like, well, how much worse can things get? Oh, much, much worse.
Yeah.
Until you're in that final sequence gets really almost experimental film like, where it's like, it feels like he's descending into hell. Mm-hmm. It's almost like Dante's Inferno kind of deal before he finally actually does make it.
Yeah.
But then like any good 70s movie, it's just got an ambiguous, like, downer ending.
Well, one of the big things I disliked about it was the ending, because he is about to get, spoilers for whoever actually is listening to this and hasn't watched this. I don't care. I mean, like, it's, it's almost 50 years old, but like, you get to the end and, like, the Frenchman had this connection with the barmaid, right?
Yes.
Like, kept talking to her, whatever. But then Roy's character, who really had, we've seen no interaction with the barmaid at all, has his ticket to go out and then says, hey, you know what? Wait a minute. I don't want to leave quite yet. I want to dance with this lady. Like, that made no sense to me whatsoever. I'm like,
I disagree, though.
Okay. Oh, tell me, because I'm sitting here, like, not scratching my head, but going,
so So this is a guy that had buried his, he basically had spent the entire film burying his emotions, burying his humanity, had just been existing the whole time that he'd been on the lam, had merely been existing. And that was the moment where he made a decision. I'm tired of just merely existing. I'm going to actually try to live again. And so he just looked at the closest thing that was there, because the Frenchman seemed to still be clinging on to trying to do that. It felt like Scanlon was trying to, in some small way, to get a piece of his humanity back and realize that he could, he had been wasting his time, like just trying to survive. And it was like, so he just takes this opportunity to dance with her. I actually didn't mind that ending. And then it is ambiguous because the mafia does show up, which I knew they would. Like, I hadn't spoiled the film for myself. I hadn't read anything. And I just knew without a doubt that they were going to find him. I didn't know when, but that was like, they're going to find this guy. And they do. And then you just have a shot from outside the bar.
And then, walking up.
I guess you're either supposed to interpret it as a gunshot, but it also could be a car backfiring. So it's like you don't really know what goes down in there, but ultimately it doesn't matter, because it's like he was gonna die at some point anyway. But that was just like, he actually was living in that moment by having a dance with her.
So I can see where you're coming from, and I can see how you got there. To me, I was like, I don't think the character earned it. Like, I don't really feel, it feels like he turns on a dime. Like, I don't feel like the, like Roy's character kind of really actually makes that conscious choice. I mean, like, that's obviously the choice. Like, I can see where you're getting from, but still, like, going back and thinking about that, how that happened, it feels like it's a, like, instantaneous, like, hey, you know what? I'm going to get my humanity back. And it's like, no, that's, I didn't really feel that throughout the film of him trying to find that. I just felt like he's still on the run, wants to get out of where he's at, you know, get to someplace better possibly. And this is his way out. And then all of a sudden he's just like, oh, hey, like it almost feels like the director did this specifically so that Roy's character will stay there so that the mafia can arrive and do that to hit up that. And that feels a little forced. And so that's why one of the things I didn't like it, I was like, had he just gotten in the Jeep right away, would have missed the mafia guys and would have been gone, or, you know, or they would have passed. But, you know,
this is Friedkin. I mean, Friedkin was never super overt with some stuff. And and a lot of these films were kind of open to interpretation. I mean, but make no mistake, there's a reason, like, he's Scheider's character is basically dressed in all white. At the end of it, he's kind of been washed clean. Like, it's, he's kind of like gone through it and come out on the other side. And so it's like, that makes sense that he's wearing what he's wearing. That was very conscious creative choice. I can't even really say is the film aged well or not, because I didn't see this until like a week before you did. And I'm glad I watched it. I didn't regret seeing it. I felt like there was some cinematography in it that I was just like, this is crazy. There was some shots of the oil wells and stuff that, with flyover from helicopters. And then there's other sequences, because he basically, I forget which country they shot this in, but a lot of the film feels like a documentary. Like, it doesn't even feel like a movie. It just feels like they brought cameras down there and just started rolling, which is a real credit to the aesthetic. But it's a brutal film. I mean, plain and simple. And they just don't usually do stuff like this with a stripped down narrative like this. That's the difference. Movies like this still get made, but the narrative's usually a lot more substantial and less open to interpretation. So, and characters are given more of a backstory.
I mean, this is definitely, I can feel like this is freaking trying something new, much like kind of like we've talked about Nolan kind of not really having, you know, intelligible dialogue of like, especially in Tenet, like, is this, how much dialogue does the audience really need to follow a story, to be engaged into a story? This could be kind of freaking going, hey, I've done French Connection. Let me try something where
The Exorcist.
Let me try these things out. Like, maybe if I just have a visual story or more imagery, like you said, The Descent into Hell, this kind of stripped down version, like, do I really need that much dialogue to get people plugged into characters? And I'm not saying this is a bad film. Like, there's a lot that is done right. Like, the rope bridge scene by itself, I mean, is absolutely astounding and amazing to this day to watch the fact that some of that stuff happened. I just think it does need a little bit more dialogue or a little bit more character building than what it has. So, yeah. I mean, I know he wrote it and a couple other people wrote it as well for the screenplay. I can see where they're going. I can see what you're talking about, but I feel like, again, it's just not earned or it's just not enough there to really draw me in.
Yeah. I wonder if, you know, flashback would have worked better for the characters and where they were and where they'd come from. And instead of the linear nature of the movie mm-hmm. of showing it at the front, that usually in and of itself tends to make things a little more interesting. But I wonder if the script was more fleshed out and it wouldn't surprise me for a second if Friedkin just started lopping out chunks of talking to really try to get the viewer into this visceral kind of place, which a lot of the film works in that regard. If you watch it just as a pure study on like tension building but you're right, you don't really care if these guys blow up or not for the most part. I mean, no. You're kind of waiting to see if it'll happen, but there isn't a lot of attachment to them. I mean, most of them have done horrible things. So it's like, part of you is like, oh, you're getting what you deserve. Like, yeah.
That's probably some of the issue is just where you're like, you're a terrible person. I don't care about you. I hope you die kind of a situation. So it's like, so that loses some of it. Instead of me wishing they would get through or like, oh no, are they going to get through it? I'm like, oh, maybe they're going to die. Yeah. Like, I mean, it wasn't that point. Like I didn't really hate these characters, but it definitely wasn't. I wasn't on their side for the most part. Even Schneider's character, like maybe he makes it, maybe he doesn't. Like I didn't really feel that. And so when he gets there and kind of has that mental breakdown,
yeah,
I'm also like, I'm there. Like I can understand where the director's taking me, but personally, I'm not there. Like, cause again, I don't truly feel for this character. Like the only one, like you said, the only one would be the Frenchman. If the Frenchman had made it, then I'd be kind of probably I would have had a little bit more brought into it because I'm like, you've gone through some more loss.
He's the only one that really had anything worth like living for. Mm-hmm. Maybe if they remade this, that might be a creative choice that somebody would make was, okay, this was the guy that actually really has a motivation to survive. Mm-hmm. Rather than just the sake of survival. But a lot of this film's issues that we're discussing are the fact that it's maybe too authentic and not following yeah. the rules of storytelling because the world is full of people that have done terrible things and we're all just trying to live to fight another day. Yeah. So, but how watchable is that?
I mean, there's definitely an art for that. That's replicating what it is, you know, but there's also the art of, you know, the talk of escapism and things of that sort in movies. And we have movies of both kinds I think of like movies like City of God, you know, where it's super brutal.
And that is a great comparison. And that is a phenomenal piece of filmmaking.
It is. It is.
And we'll have to, I'm going to add that to the list as soon as we finish recording this. That film has a main character that has a motivation to survive.
And that you can connect with and that you gravitate towards.
Yeah.
But
it shares a lot of similarities with this. Mm-hmm. Not the least of which is the fact that it's set also in South America.
Yeah.
So in Rio, but yeah, we'll have to revisit that film. That's a tremendous piece of cinema that has, I think is forgotten by too many now. So we'll have to.
I'm gonna go punch on something again that I kind of talked about, but the title Sorcerer, I'm still don't really get where it is. Cause like, and the opening sequence, like the opening things, like when it says Sorcerer, it has that image of that, you know, Mesoamerica, you know, before, you know, Crusaders, like that stone statue that laughs at you. And so I'm thinking, okay, this is interesting. What's going on? And I had read the synopsis and I was like, I don't know where that's going to happen. But then there was other points where like, I felt like there was the supernatural going to like then show up, but it never did. And so I'm still kind of like, I feel like why even have those in there? Like, was Friedkin trying to make the jungle the adversary, you know? And obviously in a lot of ways it was, mm-hmm. but it didn't really feel it was out to get them. It was more just an obstacle. Like the way like it was presented at the beginning of like what I'm trying to get at is like with the laughing kind of artwork or whatever stonework being done is that the jungle is trying to kill them. Where it felt less of that and felt more of just like, hey, here's a downed tree. Here's mud. We've got to be careful with dynamite. And it was less about the natural trying to kill them and the stuff that was, you know, human made, the dynamite that was more of the issue.
So I'm not going to go through all of the trivia on IMDb. I would encourage our listeners to do it because there's a ton of backstory here on, but I will answer why is the film called what it's called. Mm-hmm. So the original title would be The Wages of Fear, which is what the French film 1953, so I was a year off, is The Wages of Fear. So is the novel. And Frequent says that he changed the title to refer to the evil wizard of fate. That's not how you market a movie. Like, that's just... No. You want people to see your movie, you just call it The Wages of Fear.
But let's also point out the fact that even if he called it The Wages of Fear, no one's going to go see this movie in 77.
Because I don't know.
I'm sorry. A little-known film called Star Wars came out and then...
But movies were in theaters for like a year and a half in 77. Yeah, so,
but still, like
I just love that this got a, because it was the ratings were what they were. This movie is rated PG.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Well, that's right. Because it was like 89 or 87 when PG-13 finally came
84.
Out. 84. Was it 84?
Wow. It's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
That was the first PG-13 movie?
That's why they came up with PG-13. It's the heart rip scene.
Kalima, that we referred to before.
That basically, the violence, in that film, basically
I knew created, it was the 80s, but I didn't
created
know it was...
PG-13. But yeah, there's a lot of great trivia on this, on how bad of a shoot it was and stuff. But that was pretty much most William Friedkin films. He had the nickname Hurricane Billy for a reason, because he was great. He had an absolute wicked temper, would fire people on the spot. People quit his movies all the time. And after this, there's like a gap in time on his filmography before he like does a bunch of stuff again, because he just burnt people out. He just wasn't a pleasant director to work under. I mean, cinematographers. So the cinematographer on this quit halfway through. They bring in a second assistant camera operator to finish the film. They both get credit. He just burned through crew.
Yeah.
Like, William Friedkin is an immense talent. I'm not disputing this. But the thing is, the guy could have made a lot more big studio pictures into the 80s. And he did To Live and Die in LA and some other stuff. But his career, I think, could have been better had he just been a better human being. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just be talented and be a jerk and expect to have a long career. I mean, I did see his later stuff, like with Samuel L. Jackson.
Oh, that's the Rules of Engagement.
Yeah, he did do Rules of Engagement and The Hunted. And I did see Bug, which was one of his last movies. Yeah, just a wicked temper. Yeah. Immense talent.
And you can see that in The French Connection and Poltergeist. You can see that genius come out.
You mean Exorcist. Yeah.
Exorcist. Sorry.
Yeah. And he won his Oscar for French Connection, actually. Yeah.
Well, because French Connection is fantastic. Like, there's so much brilliance in that I feel like we missed out on because of him not, you know, being so hard to work with that he wasn't given those better jobs or those better scripts and kind of had to fight his way through doing different stuff. And it shows up later on when he does the other films, 12 Angry Men. Like, they're good, but...
their TV movie version.
I feel like he could have done so much better. He could have had so many much better films or directed better stuff, or we could have been putting his name up as one of the greats, you know, as opposed to, I mean, not that he's not great, but looking at his body of work, I mean, he's got some good movies, but he's also got a lot of not.
Yeah, but what's great about being a film director is you're usually not judged by your total body of work. You're usually just judged by the top end of your body of work. And so by that metric, you have The French Connection, The Exorcist, even this movie, To Live and Die in LA. Like, even if his filmography is just The Exorcist and The French Connection, like, so many directors go through their career and they'll never produce anything touching either of those movies.
True. True.
I mean, one of the, in many people's eyes, the greatest horror film of all time. And then a landmark, you know, crime drama, standard bearer crime drama still. And then arguably, you know, top two or three car chase, probably. I know many people that consider the car chase in French Connection number one. Mm. And it's a good movie on top of that. So yeah. I think he's kind of an all-timer. And I think he probably mellowed out, but by that point, it was probably too late.
Too late, yeah. It would have been interesting to see what he could have done with more people behind him or with bigger budgets. I think French Connection is great, but I think there's a lot of directors who have one or two great movies, but then don't do anything else, you know? And like you said, you usually get judged on your great movies and those kind of things. But I think sometimes you also got to see, like, what is the standard? Like, what's his usual? Like, what does he usually produce or what does he usually direct? How good are those? You know, you could do great on one, but then never replicate it.
Yeah, but you and I both know how hard it is to just make a movie, let alone make a good one. So
that's true. That's true. So
there's something about his aesthetic that jived with the 70s, like his tone and pacing. He's just kind of made for the 70s. And and once the 80s came rolling around, and I don't think he was really able to adapt either. Plus, I think he had burnt through crew. And he fought like hell with the studio on Sorcerer as well. I mean, they just... and he did. I just saw on there, they did confirm he lopped out dialogue, was trying to tell a story visually.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. He was trying to minimize the dialogue for the audience where they would just follow it with what was happening on screen.
One of those things where, like, I could see where he's going, and it's taking those chances that make a lot of times this art interesting, of like, you're not following the mold. But I completely agree with you. Had there been more dialogue or more buildup of these characters at the beginning, I would have been able to, you know, get closer to them or kind of feel connection to them, and then would have made everything else that much more powerful. Like, honestly, you could have almost no dialogue from the moment they kind of get in the trucks until the end of the film. And I feel like there was very little dialogue. Like, I think that would still work. You don't need dialogue for that. It's so tense. It's so interesting. It's just the front half that doesn't bring me into this point of caring about these characters.
Yeah.
So,
but I appreciate the risk taking. This is like the most risk averse industry on the planet, Hollywood. I mean, we're in like the most risk averse era. Mm-hmm. I think that Hollywood's been in probably since the 50s or 60s, maybe, because you just look at what's being produced and it's just, it looks like it's pressed out of a cookie cutter, with the exception of a few things on the high end with auteurs that are basically granted blank checks. The irony is those are the movies making all the money, and then
they don't.
The tier actually below that's cookie cutter. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's losing hundreds of millions of dollars. So,
and while Marvel has done some great things, it's also changed that everyone wants to have that connected universe, and all their movies have to connect, and they do this buildup. And
it's over, though, dude. The party's over.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
It's done.
Even with Marvel, it doesn't work anymore. Like, they did their Infinity War saga, and they've lost it.
The superhero party is over, and frankly, I'm excited about it because I want more risk taking, maybe lower budget films like this that I might not love, but at least I think they're interesting. And I was on the edge of my seat for this one, even though I could see its shortcomings while I was watching it. It's ruthless. It's completely unrelenting, unforgiving.
And the action in it is definitely actually engaging, as opposed to many of the superhero movies now. It's like whatever. It's get the spectacle over and let's get it back on with the story.
Anything as we wrap up Sorcerer?
No. I mean, again, I came off to the beginning of this conversation not hating on the film. Like, I feel like 7.7 is a little high for it, in my opinion. But for me, it didn't reel me in. It didn't connect with me. While there were set pieces and action sequences and parts that were great, I feel that there is definitely flaws in this film that, if just tweaked, could make this an even greater film than what it is now.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. But I'll just reiterate, I appreciate the risk taking in a movie like this. And is it everybody's cup of tea? No. And it's kind of obscure, I think, for a reason, because a lot of it is a little bit clunky.
And Star Wars came out
in 77.
Yeah.
Dominated for like 16 months, however long, 2 years it was in theaters. Well,
and keep in mind, cinemas weren't multiplexes a lot of times back then too. So it's like an either or kind of a situation.
Yeah.
So.
But yeah, if somebody's curious, hadn't seen this movie and wants to sit through it, I think it's pretty cheap rent on Amazon or Prime or something. It's a couple bucks if you just wanted to. I don't think it's super expensive. I can't tell you why I actually purchased it on Blu-ray. It was not expensive. I think I spent less than $10 on it. And it's part of my collection now. And if I want to fast forward to the amazing bridge sequence,
you can.
Then I can. It's incredible. Absolutely. It's worth watching just for that sequence, I think. And if you want to power through and just get but the other sequence that's cool too before we go is when Kasim builds that bomb to blow the tree.
Yes.
The down tree. That's freaking cool. So it has its moments. It could probably be 30 minutes shorter, but
that's the subtitle of the Cinema A to B podcast.
Yeah. The Cinema A to B, this movie could be 20 to 30 minutes less. Yeah. No, we appreciate everybody tuning in once again, as we discuss a lesser known piece of cinema from the late 70s. And we will be back on here next week with something new. So thanks for tuning in.
Thanks, everybody.